It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up on Central Time, President Obama requested congressional authorization for the use of force against the Islamic State today. We'll look at the details of that request.
But first, a bill being floated in the state legislature would allow Wisconsin's 16 technical colleges to open their own charter high schools.
Under the proposal, college instructors would teach high school courses focusing on occupational training or science, technology, math, and engineering courses.
Here to tell us more about the proposed program is Representative Thomas Weatherston, a Republican state representative from Racine. He's co-author of the bill. Representative Weatherston, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you. And actually, I'm not from Racine. I'm from Caledonia. We'll let Corey Mason say he's from Racine.
Ah, apologies. Well, thanks for the correction. Well, tell us how this program would work.
Okay, this is a very simple idea that allows our technical colleges to do charter technical high schools. And this is aimed at the middle skill levels, anything from dental hygienists to plumbers, welders, carpenters, or whatever the market deems in the area. But the bill is designed to help kids that are not college-bound or maybe at-risk young people, and then give them another path for training and skill development so that they can get family-sustaining jobs once they've graduated from that curriculum.
Why do you think Wisconsin's education needs this now?
Well, I think, you know, many of our schools, our public schools, are focusing more and more on college-bound curriculums and have gone away from the traditional trade-type jobs. And by allowing our tech colleges to have a tech college high school, we can put more emphasis back into those skill sets, which are indeed where the market is in the state of Wisconsin right now for jobs.
Why do you think it's to the advantage of students to pursue an avenue like this, a charter high school aimed at technical skills, instead of doing the usual route, which is graduating high school and then specializing and going to a technical college or a regular college?
Well, that's a good question, but it's the long way around, you know, and I think a lot of kids, I'll admit I went to a technical high school back in New York State, and which gave me quite a leg up on future endeavors. Unfortunately, what I see in my district is a lot of young people are dropping out of high school instead of finding other ways to become trained or skilled. And so this program is to just give them one more path where if they don't want to stay within the traditional high school model, they can move to a technical high school model and get them a leg up on a skill that will actually give them employment things. It also gets them into the tech school where if they enjoy the school and the learning environment, they possibly can even stay long enough to get an associate's degree.
Do you think that it's possible students would go through this program, get some training, and then opt not to go to any kind of college?
Well, possibly. You know, I think if the, you know, like a dental hygienist, if you did a program like that, and you possibly could go to work directly from a program like that, or at least after you get your associate's degree. I myself, you know, I after I graduated from a technical high school, I went in the service, and then I went back to college afterwards on the GI Bill. So I can see where you could use it both ways, but I would think that the goal, of course, is to save kids that are at risk and to help them into a career path that at least gives them a decent salary.
Now, aren't there other programs that offer this same kind of option for students that exist already, like the course options program, which lets students take two classes at a technical college or a college now?
There are those programs, and they are very successful. And now I'm most familiar with Gateway Technical College down in my district, and they have a very successful program in Burlington, Wisconsin, that works very well. But not all public school districts allow those partnerships and actually try to block some of them. So this is just an avenue to create a bigger technical ed program, if you will. You know, the programs you're talking about, like you said, you're allowed to take two courses per semester that are at the tech school level. This would allow you to be at the tech school completely and be immersed in programs and even math and English and all those other courses that go with the technology that you're trying to master.
Now, this proposal, it would allow tech colleges to open up independent charter schools that operate without a school board. Why would you take this approach rather than, say, urging technical colleges to work more closely with public high schools and expanding it through public schools?
Well, again, part of the problem is that some of the public high schools are the ones blocking work with the tech colleges. And the goal is to get kids, especially kids that are at risk, and to save them from dropping out and becoming burdens on society later in life. So the goal is to help kids find ways to get some kind of technology education that they can apply to a job skill.
Now, you said you want to make sure at-risk kids get funneled into a vocation early on. Are you concerned at all that it might be too early to decide what you want to do with the rest of your life at that level?
No, I don't think so. I think that getting a high school diploma is a major goal, and if you get that high school diploma from a tech ed school or you get it from the normal high school path, I think that is more meaningful than just dropping out of school and not having a high school diploma at all.
Funding for public education is a big issue in the state of Wisconsin. Are there concerns here that this could move money away from public schools and funding public schools?
Well, that's always a concern, and it's a valid concern. But if a child drops out of school, they lose that money anyway. So I think it's a win-win for us as a society to keep people in school as long as possible and get them the training they need.
Now, a school can exert a lot of influence on the town that it's in, and there's a lot of generally community involvement around a school. Do you think that letting charter high schools open in towns without a more community-based approach, the way that a school board offers, could be something that has consequences?
I'm not sure I understand that question. Could you restate that, please?
Would letting charter high schools open in towns without the use of a school board affect the town in a way that they didn't have much control over?
Oh, I don't think so. High school is a high school. They'd still have to come under the DPI regulations for high school, so I don't see how that would affect them.
Are there other programs, do you think, that could fit the bill instead of expanding charter schools through this? Because this is something that's being considered right now. Are there other ways to achieve this goal?
Well, there's other ways, but I don't. Most of them are post high school graduation, and if you have to wait till you've graduated from high school to get into some of these other programs, there's a German model going on down in my area where it's a German apprenticeship program, but you have to be a high school graduate to even get into it. So those are great programs, and they work very, very well, but again, you have to graduate from high school first, and not all of the kids in my neighborhood are actually making it through school.
Now, if this goes through, what do you see as being the impact on Wisconsin's workforce in the coming years?
Well, hopefully it would be very successful, and if we can train people, and that's why I said, if we could leave the tech schools, allow them to be market-driven as to what kind of training they would give, I think that if they could do partnerships, especially with local manufacturers, and train people into whatever those skills are, that they can feed directly into workforce. I see a great benefit from that by getting people into the middle skill jobs and getting them employed.
Representative Weatherston, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you.
We've been speaking with Representative Thomas Weatherston, a Republican state representative from Caledonia. He's talking about a bill he's co-authoring that would allow Wisconsin's technical colleges to open their own charter high schools.
Coming up, it's our weekly look at Congress. The president has requested authorization for the use of military force against ISIS. We'll hear how congressional leaders are responding.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll look at the state of financial stress in America. Spoiler alert, money is the number one thing stressing us out these days. We'll talk about how to deal with that kind of financial stress.
First, President Obama sent a formal request today to Congress for a 3-year authorization of military force against the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. Right now, it's our weekly look at Congress with USA Today Washington correspondent Paul Singer.
Also on the agenda today, we're getting closer to the likelihood that President Obama will issue his first veto of this Congress on the Keystone XL pipeline bill. Paul Singer joins us every week at this time. Paul, good to have you back.
How you doing, Rob? Good to be here.
I'm doing pretty good. Well, let's start with this authorization for the use of military force. We're already using military force, so what is this authorization asking for exactly?
Right. Well, in fact, the Obama administration argues that they don't actually really need the authorization, that they have all the authority they need, but that they want authorization from Congress, largely because they want Congress on the record standing beside the administration in this fight against ISIS. And it's really symbolic in some way that Congress essentially says, we agree these are bad people and we should be engaged in military conflict to stop them. Now, The trick, of course, is that when Congress, even doing something that is essentially symbolic like that, Congress may start to add some restrictions that will make the Obama administration very uncomfortable. And this is the challenge of any time trying to get Congress to essentially approve war footing, is that they then say, well, but maybe only a little bit bombing or a little more bombing. And that becomes hard to navigate.
Yeah, the president, as you say, has said he has the legal authority to bomb ISIS already. Is there language in here that would let him do more than that?
There's a couple of issues in the way the language is defined. One is that I think that there are some people who would argue that it actually would allow him to expand the region in which he is pursuing ISIS into other countries. There is also some question about whether it would allow him to engage ground troops in a way that currently the administration says they don't want to or plan to, but they might have to at some point. And I think you'll see some Democrats saying that we and also some Republicans saying that we shouldn't be committing to an eternal war on the ground again in Iraq and perhaps even Syria. You'll see a lot of Republicans, oddly enough, saying, no, the president should have as much leeway as he needs to, as commander-in-chief, execute a military campaign.
Are we seeing a lot of parsing of language from people in Congress right now of what the president has drafted?
Yeah. I mean, there's going to be hearings. There's going to be, you know, a real sit-down discussion about exactly what language to use. You know, is a three-year timeline the right timeline? How often should the administration report back? I mean, there'll be all kinds of everybody sees in this language whatever they want to see. Because, again, keep in mind, because it is symbolic, not really binding, it's not entirely clear how much any of it really means, and therefore you can read into it almost anything.
Is there a concern that, okay, we're operating on this 2001 request or approval authorization for use of force? Likely the people who voted on that weren't thinking this is going to apply to this situation 14 years down the road, so we got to be careful this time not to authorize something unexpected 10-15 years from now.
I think that also to some degree speaks to one of the reasons why people want to have this discussion now, is because the old authorizations for military force are getting old, and in some ways are very broad. And much broader than this. My understanding is that this would replace the 2002 authorization for the war in Iraq, but it wouldn't replace the 2001 authorization that basically allows the administration to go anywhere and kill anybody who is a threat to the United States, which is still in effect and still scares some people because it's pretty broad. So, you know, I think you get into these, you know, how many angels on the head of a pin kind of arguments, but you're talking about whether or not this nation is committed to a military campaign against ISIS. And despite the fact that we already are fighting that campaign, this is Congress's opportunity to say, well, yes, we believe in it, but we have some caveats.
It seems like this could end up anywhere from Congress passing something that says, you know, something watered down like ISIS is bad, to a really detailed here's how and when and how long and how much reapproval we need. It could be anywhere in between those two points, it seems like.
That's possible, and I think even, you know, another concern is that it could get to the point where Congress can't pass it at all. I think the worst possible outcome for the Obama administration, really, at this point, would be a resolution where Congress can't back it. It would just be another embarrassment for the administration. You'll remember that they tried to get authorization to use military force against the Syrian government, and that basically was about to get defeated in the Senate, and so they pulled it back and instead had some negotiations that may or may not have succeeded in the same kind of goals. But anyway, it's a bit of a wild card. You know, I think Congress wants to endorse this. They want to endorse this action, but how they get the language there, I just don't know.
Speaking of things that Congress can't all get on the same page on, we've talked a little bit about the Homeland Security Department. Republicans trying to pass a thing that, in the funding for Homeland Security, takes away some of the executive actions the president has done on immigration. What's the update? What's the latest on that?
I can't say it on the radio, but Mr. Boehner in the House today, the Speaker of the House, had some fairly coarse words for the Democrats in the Senate. Essentially, the Senate gave up on this bill a couple of nights ago and and said, we can't pass it. So now the House has to do something and come up with something that we can pass. And Boehner said, essentially, this is the fault of the Democrats who are just saying no on everything, and they should, I paraphrase, get off their butts and do something other than vote no. So at the moment, we don't know. I mean, we've got a week. We've got to fund the Homeland Security Department. Who knows? My best guess, honestly, at this point, is they'll come up with some sort of a short-term, you know, month or so funding bill just to keep it open for a while they scratch their heads a little more about what to do. You know, Congress is out of session next week, so they're not a lot of time.
So this is one of those situations where nobody probably wants Homeland Security funding to lapse, and yet they keep inching closer to exactly that.
Right. Your Congress in mind, my friend.
Well, let's talk Keystone XL pipeline. Big ticket item today. By the end of the day, President Obama is going to have to start thinking about how and when to veto something that's passed both chambers of Congress.
Right. This will be his first opportunity to veto a bill from this Republican-controlled Congress in the House and the Senate. And it's a bipartisan bill. I mean, it has support of Republicans and Democrats, not the majority of the Democrats, but the minority of Democrats. And, Obama's argument all along has been, well, this pipeline is in the administrative review process. There is a process for determining whether or not it should be constructed to get a permit, and that process should continue and should not be circumvented. The Republicans argue that this is a big jobs boon for the United States, 40,000 jobs in construction of this pipeline and really helping the energy sector. Democrats say these are all short-term jobs. Congressman Bobby Rush on the floor of the House today said you would get more permanent jobs out of a franchise burger joint on the corner than you would out of this pipeline. I think the Democrats argue now, why are we bothering to pass this thing since we know that Obama's going to veto it? And the Republicans are saying, well, Obama said he wanted a bipartisan bill. We're giving him one. How come he's vetoing it?
Even with some bipartisan support, not enough to override a veto, right?
No. In the Senate, it only passed with 62 votes. They'd need 67 to override a veto, so we don't see where they get those votes.
Is there a plan B? I've heard some talk that, we won't pass a Keystone pipeline bill. We'll take an energy bill that we need to pass, put Keystone in it, and then see if the president's willing to veto that whole package.
Sure, but that's down the road a piece. You've seen in this Congress, and this is not to disparage the Republicans, but you have seen in this Congress, they are not shy about, making the point once, then making it again, then making it a third time. So it would not surprise me at all that if the president vetoes this bill, it'll show up in some other bill. Any kind of energy package is going to take much, much longer, and frankly, it's probably going to run into some of the same problems once it gets to the president's desk anyhow, given the differences that this administration has with the Republican leadership on stuff like climate change and energy development.
Briefly, a sign of things to come for the next few years, this back and forth, Senate Democrats blocking this, vetoes blocking that?
Yes. That is, as briefly as I can state it, yes. That is where Congress, we now have a fully Republican Congress. It used to be the Democratic Senate would block House bills. Now it's going to be the president.
Well, I want to get into a story that you have been reporting on from one of our neighboring states, Congressman Republican Aaron Schock from Illinois. Give us the background on that story.
Washington Post reporter walks into Aaron Schock's office in the House office building here in Washington, and it is decorated bright red. It looks like a room from Downton Abbey. And in fact, the receptionist says, yeah, it's Downton Abbey inspired. We started to look into some of Congressman Schock's expenditures and discovered that he had previously spent about $100,000 worth of taxpayer money on renovating his district offices. That's a lot. Most congressional renovations are $10,000 paint and plaster jobs. This one had hardwood floors and granite countertops. We have not yet seen pictures of the renovation, but we saw the expenses. Then we discovered that the congressman has spent more than only about a dozen other members of Congress on travel. He's been chartering aircraft to travel around a district in Peoria, Illinois. Doesn't seem like it would be that expensive to do that much travel, but he's one of the top 15 travel spenders in the House of Representatives. So now the congressman has a lot of explaining to do about exactly what he's been spending all this money on. This is all taxpayer dollars. He has to answer to whether or not it's a good expenditure of those dollars. And, of course, we're also looking, continuing to look for, are there expenditures that simply should not have been made?
Has he responded to these stories?
Not really. I mean, what he said was, you know, he travels a lot in the district because he makes a commitment to be on the ground everywhere, to go meet his constituents wherever they are, which is, you know, fair, except, I mean, both the senators in Illinois travel less than he does, and they represent the entire state, so it's hard to make that case. He has not responded to any of the specific allegations about any of the construction costs. He has said that he'll make sure that he pays for the design of his Downton Abbey office, which he's also said was not actually Downton Abbey office. He says he never watches the show. So who knows? I mean, it once again is just a way to look at the bizarre things that happen when you remember that each member of Congress runs their office as their own small business with their own budget.
We'll leave it there for now, but I assume you'll be watching that story in the future. Paul, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks, Rob. Have a great day.
You too. That's USA Today Washington correspondent Paul Singer. He joins us every week at this time to give us the latest news from Congress.
Coming up after the news, we'll talk about the intersection of money and stress and what we can do to take some of the pressure off. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferrett. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Are you feeling stressed about money? Well, if so, it's not a great feeling, but according to new research, you're not alone.
A recent study from the American Psychological Association dug into what's stressing out Americans. Nearly three-quarters of those surveyed said they had stressed about money at some point in the last month. More than a quarter said they are stressed out about money most or all of the time. That's leading to some serious consequences, even things like adverse health effects.
The CEO of the American Psychological Association says that all Americans need to do to address the issue sooner or later in order to better their health and their well-being. But when it comes to money, where do you start?
Joining us now is Lynette Calfani-Cox. She's the CEO and co-founder of themoneycoach.net. She's a former financial news journalist and the author of several books on money matters. Lynette, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me. Good to be back again.
Well, since that big recession, the economy has rebounded a fair amount, but according to the study, we're still pretty stressed out about money. So how big of an issue do you see this here in 2015?
I think financial stress is a huge problem for most Americans all across the board. And I know the APA study looked at, you know, both higher income respondents as well as lower income folks who were surveyed. But I would argue that all groups stress about money, whether that's low income, moderate or middle income folks, or even high net worth individuals who stress more about sort of keeping and maintaining their wealth. And so I really do think it's a very, very pervasive problem in America.
Money's a pretty fundamental thing. Do you see it as something that gets tangled up in all the other forms of stress, maybe even as a root cause of some of the other stuff?
I would say it is, in fact, a root cause, certainly of family stress and relationship stress. I mean, when you think about it, 7 out of 10 couples who divorce actually cite financial strife as one of the causes for the breakup. We certainly know that there are clear links to financial anxiety and physical illnesses and not, you know, feeling well. I was on Dr. Oz, as a matter of fact, last year talking about this, a concept called MAD, money anxiety disorder, because when you're stressed out about finances, you tend to get more headaches. You feel that, you know, stressful feeling in the pit of your stomach, sleepless nights, anxiety. For some people, it leads to ulcers, worrying. So we know there are, in fact, physical as well as psychological, emotional, and relationship-based links when you have financial stress as well.
Well, I know you want us, as the money coach, to think about our money seriously, take it seriously, do things about it, take steps. But how do we draw the line between thinking about this issue and tackling it and obsessing about it, feeling stressed about it all the time?
Well, I think you have to recognize the things that you have control over and then acknowledge the things that you, frankly, have absolutely no control over. So you could stress about any number of financial matters. You can think about, oh, my house is underwater, you know, because the balance on my mortgage is now greater than the amount that the house is worth. But you have absolutely no control over real estate values. You can, you know, keep your house up and not, you know, let it get, you know, worn down, you know, unduly, but you really can't control local real estate values. Ditto for the stock market. You know, I think a lot of people tend to have a lot of anxiety when they watch and see, okay, the Dow was up 100 points yesterday, down 10 points today. And so the vicissitudes of the stock market, those vagaries alone can make people feel, you know, very much out of sorts and very stressed. So, you know, step one is sort of try not to have anxiety about things that are absolutely out of your control, because you can't do anything about them anyway. Step two is to sort of identify your stressors and really think about what causes you the most amount of emotional insecurity when it comes to your finances. Are you worried primarily, for instance, about today? So a lot of people say, I'm worried about paying my rent or my mortgage. I have credit card bills to pay. I've got to keep the gas and the utilities on. Those are, of course, present-day financial concerns. But then a lot of people worry tremendously about the future. So they might have kids, and they're thinking, how in the world will I be able to foot the college bills down the road? How will I be able to, you know, have a secure retirement? Those are the things that you can diminish your stress tremendously by just taking bite-sized steps and doing a little bit at a time. So the progress you make, for example, towards saving for retirement will diminish your anxiety and stress about an event that's going to take place, say, 15 or 20 years down the road.
I want to talk a little bit about some numbers from the survey. It found that 12% of respondents said they skipped a doctor's visit because of financial concerns. 32% said their finances prevented them from living a healthy lifestyle. And I wonder if some of the stress about money is just something that we can't do anything about because we have our income is what it is. We can't just have more money because we want to have more money. Is some of this just powerlessness about how much money we have?
Well, I think that that might be sort of an easy sort of default position to take and to sort of say and accept, you know, it is what it is and you're not going to make above X. This is your salary. But there are some things that you can do. Certainly, if you're making a very modest salary, then one of the challenges is, of course, to live within your means, right? So, yes, if you sit up and watch reality TV all day and then you have aspirations to live like the bling-bling lifestyle like you might see on television, or if you're constantly comparing yourself to what your neighbor has, or if you're trying to, you know, get the latest and greatest of anything, the newest car model, the most recent tech gadgets, et cetera, then you're actually making choices, right, that are going to potentially cause you to feel financial stress and to be financially stressed because you don't have the economic resources to support that kind of lifestyle. Nor is it, in many cases, frankly, very desirable or at least advisable. So part of it is if you are feeling cash-strapped and like you're living paycheck to paycheck, one step is to certainly evaluate the choices you've been making. Because I'll tell you, there's a lot of people who live on very modest salaries who actually don't feel so cash-strapped all the time. I was reading about a janitor just yesterday who retired and passed away and left $8 million to colleges and various charities. Nobody even knew this guy was a multimillionaire, but he had a very modest salary. And, but over the course of a lifetime, he had been a diligent saver and he'd been a person who, you know, had humble roots and sort of stayed true to that. So even if you feel like, I only make X annually or X per hour, part of the challenge to not feel financially stressed is to align your spending patterns and your choices in terms of what you're doing with your money with your true goals. So if you say family is important to me, for example, then it shouldn't be about spending on the latest pair of tennis shoes or a purse or a bag or, you know, the latest iPhone. Maybe you want to make smarter choices and say, I'm going to spend time with the family. So instead of buying all these things, all this stuff throughout the course of a year, maybe I'll save up money to have less stress and to be able to take a week's vacation with the family. So this way you get the dual benefit of that. You get to relieve some stress by having a little bit of downtime, but you also get the sort of family togetherness. But it's about planning and making choices. And again, not necessarily saying I'm going to follow the herd or I'm going to do what everyone else is doing.
Now, a lot of times money is one of those things that we don't talk about, a bit of a taboo topic. Do you think that because we don't maybe talk about our financial stress or financial troubles, that makes it all the more stressful?
I do, because I think in a lot of ways, a lot of people who have financial troubles feel like they're alone. They typically beat themselves up, right? And they feel like, how could I have been so foolish or I got myself into this mess, and I'm the one that has to get myself out. You have to sort of, feel like you have to financially pull yourself up by your bootstraps. And there's a lot of research that also backs that up. Fidelity, I know, came out with a new survey recently that talked about the extent to which women in particular will discuss a whole range of things, their weight, sex, et cetera. But when it came to money issues, they were not so keen on talking about, say, salary issues, spending habits, and things related to money. So it is the case that, sort of culturally, I think that for a lot of people, it's not deemed to be proper, let's say, to talk about money. Some people consider it kind of tacky or gauche, or they just sort of think that if I talk about money, I don't want it to seem like I'm bragging if they're doing well, nor are people who might be, say, dating, and we're coming up, on Valentine's Day very shortly. Some people are thinking, should I have the money talk with my significant other? No, maybe not. I don't want to seem like a gold digger, or I don't want to, taint the romance by introducing, finance. but we do have to get comfortable with it. We do have to be willing to have these conversations, and even a lot of us have to be willing to share our own mistakes and our setbacks, because it does tend to open up conversation, and it lets others know we're not perfect. Nobody is. We've all had our challenges, but this is a way that you can learn from it by talking to other people about what they've done that has worked and what they've done that wasn't so good and so positive or productive.
Whether it's a taboo topic or not, we're talking with Lynette Kalfani-Cox about money and stress. A recent survey from the American Psychological Association finds that the vast majority of Americans are stressed about their finances. We want to hear from you on this.
How stressed are you about money? Is that stress affecting your personal life, maybe your relationships or your health? And what do you do to try to manage your financial stress? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking about money and stress. According to a new survey, it's the number one thing that's stressing Americans out. So we're taking a look at what that stress is doing to us and how to manage it. And we want to hear from you on this.
How would you describe your personal level of stress when it comes to money issues? Is it affecting your personal life, your relationships, or your health? How do you cope? And do you have advice on maybe how you dealt with an issue financially or emotionally? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Our guest is Lynette Kalfani-Cox. She's the CEO and co-founder of themoneycoach.net. And we go to our first caller now. We've got Andy with us in Chippewa Falls. Hi, Andy.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
Good. I guess I'm a relatively young person, 26 years old, and there are certainly a lot of money stresses. I went to college, so I do have some student loans that I'm paying back, trying to get them out of the way as soon as I can. So. Also, utilities, things that everyday people worry about. So there's just a lot out there, got to tell you.
Right. Well, thanks so much for sharing that, Andy. Appreciate it. And Lynette, Andy has got a lot of people in his boat dealing with student loans.
Sure.
And then just the cost of living and, transitioning from college into a professional life, too.
That's right. Andy, he said he's 26. He's in that millennial category where, their number one concern is about debt. And so, obviously a huge financial problem, student loan debt is at $1.2 trillion in America. So, you know, the typical college grad had, from the class of 2014, had about $33,000 in student loans. He didn't say what his are, but, you know, it's taking, you know, on average 10-plus years for most college grads to pay back their loans. And in many cases, it's two decades. So that's a very, very real concern for a lot of folks in their 20s. And you pointed out, Veronica, very good consideration as well. They're transitioning, right? So they're going from the college environment or perhaps living with mom and dad to making a way on their own and living in, quote-unquote, the real world. So that's the point in their life at which they have to first really effectively learn how to juggle bills, how to manage a budget, how to keep the checking account from getting overdrawn, how to, you know when to say yes, that they can go out with their friends, or no, they need to stay home, because all of those bills that a lot of 30-something, 40-something, and 50-something people have been navigating perhaps for a couple decades are now sort of suddenly being thrust upon them. Not to mention, because of the job market, a lot of recent college grads have to relocate. So if they can't necessarily get a job in their own backyard, wherever they went to school, they have to go to another city. And so that brings the attendant costs along with it as well. So it's a very, very real challenge.
Andy, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Lynette, any advice to get started on dealing with that challenge, that incomprehensible number that is your student loan debt, say?
Yes. The first thing is to sort of know what all of your financial options are when it comes to repayment. And certainly if you had federal loans, you have four different options. The first is to just put yourself in the standard loan repayment program. That's where you pay off your loans in 10 years. But there are three other repayment plans as well if you just can't swing your student loan repayments. There's the graduated loan repayment program, the extended loan repayment program, and the income contingent or income sensitive loan repayment options. In a nutshell, all of those will allow you to extend your loan repayments to as short as 12 years or as long as 25 and in some cases 30 years. Now, I know that sounds like putting a mortgage on your back, and there is a trade-off. If you want to have smaller loan repayments for that college debt right now, while you're just sort of getting started, you can do that by extending your student loan repayments. But of course, you'll pay more in the long run in terms of interest because you're extending and stretching those loan payments out. But for some people, in the short run, just while they get their, you know, bearings financially, or while they work up to a higher paying gig and a bigger salary, it's sort of worth it to consolidate or extend out some of those student loan options. Ditto with checking if you have private student loans. You might want to inquire with your lender about various options. If you need a forbearance or a deferment, if you're unemployed, there's options available just to keep you out of delinquency or default status.
Well, good luck to Andy, and we're going to go next to Jenny in West Salem. Hi, Jenny.
Hi, I just tuned in a few minutes ago, and I was really interested in your conversation. A gift that was given to us early in my marriage with my husband, which is going on 17 years ago, is we were invited over to my in-laws' house where they were meeting with their financial advisor. So we were in our early 20s, and we got started with a financial advisor who we continue to meet with twice a year, and we learned how to create a savings account and build that savings. Thank you.
Okay, thanks a lot, Jenny. That's an interesting gift. I bet a lot of people don't get that.
That is so awesome. What a great gift. I mean, I don't know. She said with her in-laws, so I'm not sure if the in-laws themselves provided the gift, but wow, that probably helped to keep them married for these 17 years. I mean, to get them started on the right financial footing.
So is that a good idea, going to a financial planner when you're feeling that stress?
I really do think it is. You know, a lot of very wealthy people will tell you that they have financial advisors, and in fact, they have a team of advisors typically. Now, I'll tell you what low-income and middle Americans will usually say to that. They'll say, I can't afford it. And my response is, you can't afford not to, because you actually can get You can get a fee-only advisor. You can get a financial plan created for you, and it's often much, much, much cheaper than people think. You can pay on an hourly basis for consultative help, and it's just guidance to kind of get you started or to help you stay on track. So I personally think that everybody should have a financial advice. Certainly every working adult should have someone in their corner to help them to keep on track. I might say one last quick thing, too, about professionals. It's the way in which financial stress doesn't just affect us as individuals or as, you know, part of a couple if you're in a relationship. It actually has a huge impact on America as a whole and in particular on the workforce because people who are financially stressed are actually costing, from a productivity standpoint, their employers and the labor market billions upon billions upon billions of dollars. And the reason is that financially stressed workers, just like stressed workers of any kind, are typically have higher absentee rates, more accidents on the job. They'll typically tap into employer resources at a higher rate in terms of, you know, using certain benefits, whether it's for substance abuse issues. So you can have stress from a whole bunch of issues, from your own personal relationships, from trying to juggle, you know, parental responsibilities if you have aging parents or kids. And employees certainly do tap into those type of benefits that are supplied by their employers. But I think that corporate America has not yet fully awakened to the fact that financial stress is, in fact, the number one stressor for the U.S. workforce. And it's great to have an EAP program, an employee assistance program.
And we'll leave it there, Lynette. Thanks to Lynette Calfani-Cox for joining us today, talking about a new survey on financial stress. She is the CEO and co-founder of themoneycoach.net, a former financial news journalist, author of a lot of books on money matters.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, it's Data Privacy Awareness Month. We'll get some personal advice on keeping our information safe on our home computers and other gadgets.
The author of Wide Open World was worried his family was growing apart. He packed them up and went on a world tour volunteering.
That's coming up tomorrow right here on Central Time.